morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Jesse Ventura did it last year. Can James Gibson do it next year? James Gibson, the co-owner of a Minneapolis software development firm called Distributed Programming Systems, says he has decided to run for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. Mr. Gibson, a political newcomer, will be running as a Reform Party candidate. Well, today, as part of our kind of ongoing Meet the Candidates series here on Midday, Mr. Gibson has come by our studios to talk about his campaign and take your questions. Great opportunity to find out more about this new candidate for Senate, and we hope you'll be able to join our conversation. Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Our guest this hour, Reform Party Senate candidate, James Gibson. And Mr. Gibson, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for inviting me, Gary.
Maybe the best thing to do is to find out a little bit more about you personally. You're a Minnesota native, essentially, are you not?
Yes, been here most of my life. My folks moved here when I was about 2 years old, and except for a brief stint of about 5 years in Wausau, Wisconsin, been here ever since.
So you deserted for a couple of years there, but otherwise you've been around all the time.
That's right.
And you're married?
Yes. Celeste is my wife. We've been married 16 years. Have no children.
What does your firm actually do?
We develop software, and it's I have been an independent software developer for about 20 years. So the corporation, Distributed Programming Systems, was a corporation formed with a partner, Ben Moyle. And the idea was to develop a piece of package software that was really an add-on to one of the first products I wrote. And this is marketed to mainframe sites, large IBM mainframe sites. And I think that's probably all the that would make sense. It's a piece of system software that programmers use to write programs. Like, we call it a program editor.
Do you have a lot of employees, or is it more of an independent contractor arrangement?
No, it definitely is. I do most of the development and most of the marketing. Now the co-owner owns BI Moyle Associates, and that's a firm of about 12 people based in Edina, and that's the firm we market the product through.
Mm-hmm. To paraphrase that old expression, what is a guy like you doing in a race like this? Why stick your neck out and enter politics and run for the U.S. Senate?
Well, it's an issues thing for me. I've been interested in economics all of my life, and the single defining thing for me was when Rod Grams proposed a 10% across-the-board tax cut at this particular time. It's clearly an inappropriate thing to do, and it indicated to me that he doesn't really understand the economic issues. This is a real opportunity for this nation to solve some problems, and I don't want to see it squandered.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to do with the surplus, the budget surplus?
Well, we need
in essence.
Okay, we need to use the surpluses to both retire the national debt and to properly fund the federal pension programs, including Social Security. Now, the federal debt is currently about $5 trillion. We have about a $9 trillion unfunded liability in the Social Security system. We probably have another $5 trillion in the military and federal civilian pension programs. So you add that all up, and you realize we are foisting a huge liability on the next generation. And I'd be pretty angry about that if I was a young voter. So I think it's important that the baby boomer generation in particular take responsibility for this, use whatever surpluses develop to retire that debt and to properly fund these retirement accounts.
I think Senator Grams, without putting words in his mouth, might very well argue that U.S. taxpayers deserve a break. Plus which, Republicans have historically argued that if you don't give the money back to taxpayers, the Democrats will just figure out ways to spend it on useless programs.
Well, I assure you, if I'm elected, I'm not going to participate in spending it on useless programs. If we really have congressmen, senators that can't control spending irrespective of the revenues that are coming in, we need to replace those legislators. There's no reason. Every business manages control its expenses without having to trim its revenue. The idea is to, particularly, with our need to retire these debts, is to maintain the revenues and find ways of decreasing expenses.
Mm-hmm. Why not? Running for the Senate is a big leap, and obviously you're concerned about this issue. Why not just get out there and talk about this issue and skip all the falderal of trying to run for the Senate with all that that implies?
Well, I think running for the Senate is a good forum for being heard. It's a way of becoming very credible. You can. It's very hard for an individual citizen to express his views and really make much of a difference. So that's a frustrating thing. But the moment you declare that you're serious about this, that you're going to run for the Senate, you're taken much more seriously. So that's a big motivator, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Are you primarily interested in raising these issues and talking about them, having a forum to talk about them, or do you seriously want to win and be the next senator from Minnesota?
I do seriously want to win, but I will tell you that if we have another candidate, for example, that were to run that felt strongly about these issues, I would have less of a need to run. My concern is, first and foremost, is with solving these issues and making sure this opportunity isn't squandered. As far as my personal ambitions, I would love to be senator, and if I become senator, I will give it my full effort. But I'm not going to be crushed if I don't become senator. I will feel very good about this if I express my opinions and have an effect on the issues that are talked about in this campaign.
Why the Reform Party?
Well, first of all, we need a third choice. I think that's healthy for everybody. Beyond that, I simply, when I got serious about running for the Senate, I took a look at the platforms of the various parties, and the Reform Party most closely matched my own opinions. So that gave me the freedom to simply be myself, say what I think, and not be concerned that there would be a conflict with, you know, the party's position on issues.
Mm-hmm. Have you been active in Reform Party politics up till now, or?
No, my first involvement with the Reform Party was early this year, and I simply sent an email to the leadership of the party that said I was interested in running for the U.S. Senate, and got their attention, and one thing led to another, and well, here we are today.
Have you talked to the governor yet?
I have not met the governor. I'm hoping to this weekend. I've met everybody else, you know, that has contact with the governor. Multiple conversations with Dean Barkley and Diane Goldman and the various, most of the CD chairs I've met now as well.
Mm-hmm. The governor, of course, has been outspoken in his criticism of career politicians. Do you share his thoughts on career politicians?
I don't think career politicians per se are bad, but I do think we could use a different mix in Washington. I think it's important that we get people that have been successful in other walks of life. I'd like to see more teachers in Washington. I'd like to see more businessmen. I'd like to see more engineers. I think just having a better mix would be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. What about the media? You've had a chance to watch the media from the outside as the media has dealt with the political process. What's your assessment of that? Again, I ask that primarily because, again, the Reform Party's principal actor, Governor Ventura, has jousted with the media, shall we say. What's your thought on how the media covers politics?
Well, as an outsider, it's very hard for me to answer that. I suppose I'll get an impression of that very quickly, you know, based on the kinds of things I say and what I read about myself in the paper. But at this point, you know, it's more important that I just be talked about rather than what they say about me even. So I'm not particularly concerned about that. But
are you concerned?
Ask me that in a couple of months.
Are you concerned that we're going to start poking around in your private life and picking at things that at least in your mind have nothing to do with being a senator?
No, I'm not really concerned about that. I have, by many people's standards, a pretty dull past. I just hope you don't get too bored looking.
James Gibson is our guest this hour. He is the Reform Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, the seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. Several Democrats have also expressed some interest in the seat. And we thought it'd be great today. Mr. Gibson has come by. We'll find out a little bit more about who he is, what he stands for, what he believes in. And also, he's here to take your questions. So if you'd like to call in, here's the number, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Beyond this issue of Senator Graham's proposal for a cross-the-board tax cut, is there any other major issue that you want to focus on in terms of, and I know on your website you've got a fairly extensive document printed on the Social Security issue. Without going into great detail, can you give us an overview of what you have in mind for Social Security reform?
Certainly. Well, first of all, and this is more important than whether we privatize or not, is to recognize the liability that exists and to treat it as a private corporation would treat it. We book the liability, we recognize it, we publish it, and we quit denying that it exists and we start dealing with it. I am advocating that we privatize the system. A number of reasons for this, and I think there's some real benefits to be achieved for the nation. I don't like the idea of rushing into it. This is going to take a great deal of study. It's going to take some real research, much more than I can do as a senatorial candidate. All I can do is lay out some guidelines, but it's going to take some real research to deal with all the issues. And now we're talking about the retirement portion of Social Security. Mm-hmm. The disability and survivors would likely remain intact. So, again, the most important thing is to deal with the underfunding. Now, when we talk about privatizing, what I'm talking about is, as I have it laid out now, anyone under 55 would be privatized. Anybody over 55 we'd leave intact, I'm assuming, and that number is certainly open to negotiation, but I'm just assuming that people would rather not, when they're that close to retirement, not want to be concerned about dealing with investments of any kind. They're just, mm-hmm. they're ready for retirement. So anyone under 55, we set up private accounts. And what we do is identify what the present day value of their benefits are. And we actually create a note from the federal government, place it in their retirement account, their individual retirement account, and from that point on, they're in control of that. Now, we're going to have definite limits on the kinds of things you can do with that, what kinds of investments you can make, because it's very important that we don't get individuals taking extremely high risks where they yield the upside potential, but we as a nation ultimately have to pick up the downside. So that's real important that we define standards that will work and that will provide some reasonable assurance that there'll be benefits there when needed. Okay, now for obviously new people coming on board, they have an initial balance of zero. Anything at that point that they the retirement portion of their contribution that's currently going to the Social Security system now is going to go be directed to their account. Now, what's going to happen with all of that debt we've created? There's one more element here. We're going to actually create a note from the federal government and place it in the Social Security Trust Fund to fund the underfunding that exists there. Mm-hmm. So now we have a retirement system that is actuarially sound. But what we've created is $9 trillion of debt for the federal government. So instead of a $5 trillion debt, we have a $14 trillion debt. But what we've done is to shift the burden from the Social Security system and the pressures from it over to the general fund. Now, there's a number of advantages there. First of all, I believe the underfunding is a responsibility of everybody, mm-hmm. not just current and future workers. It shouldn't be, for example, young people shouldn't be paying for that underfunding any more than a senior citizen would, or a worker shouldn't be, somebody that's making $50,000 shouldn't be, I should say, somebody that's making $70,000, for example, shouldn't be as responsible for that underfunding as much as somebody that's making $200,000. That's what tends to happen today because of the caps on Social Security contributions. So that's the essence mm-hmm. of it. We create the assets in the retirement account, So that's actuarially sound. We recognize a liability on the federal government side. That immediately puts us in a position where it's obvious that it is not appropriate to reduce taxes. We need those tax revenues now to cover the extra interest payments. And in fact, we end up committing future growth in revenue such that it's, you know, tax deduction reductions are not appropriate for any time in the near future.
And in terms of a kind of a basic level benefit, would that still be available no matter what happened to people's investments, or would it be a kind of devil take
behind
most?
Well, I think you'll find if you remove the unfunded liability of that obligation from current workers, you will find that the minimum benefit will be there without having to do anything, as long as we make sure that investments are within certain limits. So it should not be a problem. There's one other issue I want to bring up on the advantage of privatizing and what we have right now and have had. When you have a program in place such as Social Security, you declare a benefit to people, they will necessarily save less personally because they have a source of revenue later on. So they're necessarily going to save less personally. Now, that's not a major problem if the party making, you know, declaring that benefit is going to do the saving for you. What's happened, and this has had an effect since its inception, Social Security's inception, is that it has reduced national savings and economic growth, because while the individuals save less because of the existence of Social Security, the federal government is not providing an offsetting increase in savings. So this would tend to reduce that effect.
James Gibson is with us. He is the announced candidate for the Reform Party nomination for the U.S. Senate. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Darlene's on the line with a question. Go ahead, please.
I don't have a question. I just would like to say that I strongly agree with his philosophical statement that we need to use our budget surplus and so forth to take care of the national debt and the Medicare and Social Security problems so that we're not passing these on to our children and grandchildren. I'm in my 60s, and it's long been a concern of mine of the problems that we're passing on to our children that already exist, not to mention ones we know are coming down, you know, the line because of the a large number of people who would be retired. And so I certainly, and I'm so glad to hear someone saying this.
Okay.
I appreciate that, Darlene. And, yes, as you know, the children, the grandchildren, we shouldn't be foisting that obligation on them. And there's no real security for our senior citizens knowing that, because there's always the possibility that that next generation may wake up and realize this wasn't a fair thing. So it's important that we set funds aside and, you know, that everybody perceive that this generation has done what it should do, done the right thing, and been fiscally responsible.
Back to the phones. Frank, your question?
Yeah, Mr. Gibson, Sam, I read in the newspaper this morning where the Congress filed a lawsuit against Mr. Clinton for starting an illegal war. Now, after the Vietnam War, there was a War Powers Act put in place, and right now we're using our Social Security funds for this war. Now, if you become senator, how would you handle this War Powers Act?
Okay. I'm not all that familiar, actually, with the War Powers Act, but I will comment on the issue of using the Social Security funds. The issue isn't so much, and you hear this a lot, the diversion of funds from the Social Security Trust Fund for other purposes, and it's a little bit confusing. By definition, the Social Security Trust Fund buys government bonds, so by definition, those funds are in use elsewhere. The real issue is that we tend to, or the federal government tends to report the surplus number is what they call a unified budget, and it's a real dangerous concept. What they do is combine the number in the general budget with the increase in the Social Security, the surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund, and they report to us as a unified budget number. The problem is, quite often, they just call it the surplus, and I took exception with Dr. Janet Yellen. She's the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. The other day when she was in the Minnesota meeting, she kept using this term surplus, and she was referring to the unified budget surplus. Now, she's just echoing what the Clinton administration has done and others, how they refer to this. And it's a real dangerous concept, and I hope all of us just we start taking exception when we hear it. When we hear that we have surpluses, the real issue is, do we have a surplus in the general budget? The surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund exists for a reason. We're trying to accumulate dollars in there so that we're prepared. We're not anywhere near accumulating what we need to, but to the degree that the government reports this surplus to us, the unified budget surplus, there's a deception there, and it gives us the impression that we have discretionary funds available, which we don't have. And so you'll see, based on that, calls for tax reductions. And it's just not appropriate. You've got to look at that general budget fund number.
Mm-hmm. Frank was asking about the War Powers Act, and without getting into detail about the specifics of what that law is and how it works, the long and the short of it is that the law basically requires Congress to sign off if we're going to go to war. In the case of Kosovo, was that a good decision that the Clinton administration made? If you'd been in Congress and the Senate at the time, would you have voted funding for the war, support for the war?
I think you have to, when you enter negotiations, you have to know what you're willing to do at the outset. Once you enter the negotiations and you commit to a particular position, you have to be prepared to follow through on it, and it's really kind of a pointless discussion to talk about whether you're going to fund it at that point. The real decision should have been made early on. Now, if people objected to taking that position, they should have made it before we entered the negotiations. Particularly once the war started, we had absolutely no choice but to follow through on it.
Mm-hmm. And given where we are now in that part of the world, any suggestions as to, assuming this peace agreement works out, should we be spending money then to help rebuild Yugoslavia?
I don't know to what extent we should do that. I think we're going to be forced to do it to a degree. That's a tough call. Mm-hmm. I don't really know.
Yeah. Reform Party Senate candidate James Gibson is our guest this hour. He's come by. Many people have not heard of Mr. Gibson. He's a political newcomer, but he's running for the Senate in the Reform Party ticket and seeking the seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. He's been good enough to come by today to talk about who he is and what he stands for, and if you'd like to join our conversation, here's the number to call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You might get a busy signal. If so, just wait around for a while and then call back after we get through a few more callers. We'll get back to our callers in just a couple minutes.
I'm Lorna Benson. On the next All Things Considered, we'll hear from the class of 99.
I'm concerned about a lot of my friends. Some of them have absolutely no idea what they're going to do. One of my friends said that she's going to live with her parents for the rest of her life.
We've lived under our parents for 18 years, and now we're going out on our own. Yet we have to mature more, be more responsible. I don't know, it's really scary.
It's All Things Considered, beginning at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
By the way, over the noon hour today, presidential candidate Dan Quayle speaking at the Commonwealth Club. You'll recall that was the scene of his famous Murphy Brown speech. Well, former Vice President Quayle is running for president this year, and he returned to the Commonwealth Club to outline what he hopes to accomplish if he is elected president. So we'll hear that speech at noon today. That's on most of these stations. Those of you in the northern part of the state will have a special program about the future of Voyageurs National Park, so we hope you can join us. Programming at NPR is supported by the Minnesota Inventors Congress. An Inventors Convention in Redwood Falls, open to all, June 11th through the 13th. Information at 1-800-INVENT-1. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary. Good morning. Talks on a Kosovo peace deal have recessed until tomorrow. A spokesman for the NATO generals at the talks in Macedonia says the Serbs are consulting with the Belgrade government. Spokesman Robin Clifford says the talks have been constructive and that they will resume tomorrow. He says the reasons the talks are dragging on include some technical discussions prompted by the UN resolution that was crafted by G8 leaders. Former President George Bush jumped out of a plane today, 3 days before his 75th birthday. He landed gently on the lawn of his presidential library on the Texas A&M University campus. His wife Barbara and others were there to greet him. A global restructuring program means some big layoffs at Procter & Gamble. The company says it's eliminating 15,000 jobs worldwide over 6 years. Nearly a third of the cuts will come in North America. In regional news, Attorney General Mike Hatch announced a privacy lawsuit today against U.S. Bank. Hatch contends the bank gave customers private information to a telemarketing company in exchange for at least $4 million. The lawsuit alleges U.S. Bank violated federal law and engaged in consumer fraud and deception advertising. Hatch contends some of the private information released includes Social Security numbers, account balances, transactions, and credit limits. U.S. Bank Corp has not responded to the suit. Northwest Airline flight attendants are holding an informational picket today at the Twin Cities Airport. The attendants overwhelmingly authorized their union to strike last weekend. Union members have been working without a new contract for 3 years. Today's picketing should not affect flights. New Minnesota Twins ticket kiosks are being unveiled today at 19 Cub food stores in the Twin Cities metro area. Twins fans can use a touchscreen to select seats, pay with a credit or debit card, print out tickets, and even pick up orders made online. The forecast for the state of Minnesota this afternoon calls for a chance of thunderstorms statewide. High temperatures from 78 in the north to around 90 in the southeast. Checking current conditions. St. Cloud reports cloudy skies and 77 degrees. It's cloudy in Duluth and 61. Sioux Falls reports sunshine and 82. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 78 degrees. Gary, that's a look at the latest news headlines.
Thank you, Greta. 27 minutes now before 12 o'clock. Our guest during this first hour of our midday program, James Gibson, who is running for the U.S. Senate as a Reform Party member. And he has... more or less officially announced now. I guess no formal press conference or anything, but definitely in the race. And he's come by today to talk about his stand on the issues. If you'd like to call in with a question, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Doug, you're next.
Hi. I wanted to find out what your views are on a couple of other issues, like the environmental issues and gun control issues.
Okay. What I'm doing, and I don't know if this is the correct way, but I'm just taking an issue at a time and trying to become very qualified on that. I have not spent time researching environmental issues, and I'm not prepared to articulate a position on gun control either. I recently heard a presentation by John Lott on the gun control issue, and the one thing I got out of it more than anything was that I probably will need to go to raw statistics to really understand the issue, because what I see is different people putting a different spin on the same statistics, and the only way I'm going to really understand the issue is to go to a lower level of information. So that'll be my approach, but right now I'm not prepared to take a position, stand on it either way.
In general, do you think gun control laws have had any impact to speak of on gun violence in this country?
Well, that's the question that I'm having a hard time getting a good answer to. I'm just hearing, again, different spins on the same set of statistics. So I'm actually going to go in and look at, you know, what are these opinions being based upon and try to form my own opinion. I just not I don't trust what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm. In general, do you think the federal government has been too tough on businesses in this country regarding environmental laws to the point where it's stunted growth?
I heard a presentation. I think the woman was Lynn Scarlett, an environmental expert. She was making the point about looking at the environmental issues from a cost benefit. You know, what does it cost us to correct an environmental problem? What are the benefits? And you can say that's Your first impression is that you're not dealing with the environment as effectively, but the reality is what you're doing is maximizing the resources you have. It allows you to make a decision about how best to spend whatever resources you as a society are willing to devote to dealing with environmental issues. Just as a side, an aside here, and this maybe will bring up another part of the discussion. The resources a society has for dealing with problems in general are to a large degree a function of how well the economy is working and what kind of growth rate we're able to get. So it's very important that the nation grow, that the economy grow at a rate more akin to what happened in the 1950s and 1960s. We've had very slow growth rates for the last 25 years or so, and underlying that is low productivity growth rates. We need to get the kind of productivity growth rates we had in the 50s and 60s. We're talking instead of 1% productivity growth rates, we need to get them up to about 3% productivity growth rate. Part of that is making sure that we have sufficient national savings. And this ties in with the whole issue of whether we start to use those surpluses to pay down debt, because all of that money we use to pay down debt and to fund these retirement accounts ultimately goes back to the capital markets, which tends to increase investment and ultimately economic growth. The more economic growth we have, the more resources we have to devote to things like environmental issues. So it all ties back to the economy. We need to look at how we handle those resources, how we allocate them, and then what's the total quantity we have available to do that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of U.S. economic position, and I know it's tough to generalize about this, but where do you find yourself on the continuum there, the trade continuum? At one end, the free traders, on the other end, the fair traders, as they call themselves. Where you're concerned a little bit more about tariffs and the rest to protect American workers versus total immersion in the global economy. Where do you see yourself on that spectrum?
Well, I think it's axiomatic among economists, the value of global trade. It's here, it's not going away, and there's benefits that we all achieve from that. What we have to be concerned with is particular groups that get hurt by that, and are there ways of easing that pain? We shouldn't interfere with transitions. If anything, government should encourage the transitions and perhaps help people to adjust to those dislocations. There's a role for government to play in that. You know, if we have an industry that is disappearing because of international trade, what's going to happen to those workers, and how do they get relocated in this economy? The government has a role to play in that. Now, that's constructive. To put up protectionist barriers, as a rule, is not. That's counterproductive, and we all pay a price for that. I'll make another point here. We have a lot of industries that are dependent. They're net exporters, and they are dependent upon the global markets. To the degree that we erect protectionist barriers, we hurt those industries. So I can make a case that every time we erect a barrier, for example, we hurt a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
But we hurt other industries as well. But the important thing is that we encourage this kind of trade and that we deal with the dislocations, but not prevent that.
Mari's on the line with a question. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mr. Gibson. I'd like to kind of follow up on Doug's question about some of your other views, and I was wondering if you have developed a position on women's reproductive rights.
I'm not prepared to articulate it all, but I'll just throw out some concerns of mine. The further along in the pregnancy, the more concern I have. I am concerned about late-term procedures, partial birth procedures. I think a lot of people are very concerned with the grimness of it, if you will. And I think there's a role, there's some discussion, I think, public discussion that should be had about that. In general, I'm not in favor of restricting a woman's right to choose. I'd like to see the society get beyond this debate and start talking about productive ways to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies. That's something we can all agree on, and I think there's much that can be done in that area.
Craig's up next with a question from Brainerd. Craig?
Yes.
Go ahead.
You made a comment about trying to generate the types of productivity increases in the economy that were common in the 50s and 60s. Can't happen. What we had then was a manufacturing economy that was seeing the first influx of information technology, computer numerical controlled machining, and this type of thing, the beginning of automated machining in our manufacturing sector. We are now in an information service economy, and everyone knows that you cannot generate that kind of productivity increase in that type of an economy. And so the conditions are not, it's not going to happen. And the other thing is that it would be, at this point, it would be so hyperinflationary that interest rates would climb up over 17% within a matter of years. So.
Okay.
Okay, Craig. I asked Alice Rivlin, who's the vice chair of the Fed, this question the other day, and her answer was, it's more of a mystery why we haven't achieved 3% productivity in the last 25 years than it is a mystery why we were able to achieve it in the 50s and 60s. You say that productivity is, if we get the 3% productivity improvement that we're talking about, something that would be very inflationary. Productivity allows wages to grow without inflation. All we're really talking about when we talk about productivity is what's the average amount of work that's being done by a particular person in a given amount of hour, in a given hour. The question is, how do we increase that? Well, I think if you think about the kinds of things you do every day, you probably can determine ways you could accomplish more. It's just a question of what you'd need to do that. A particular piece of equipment. I looked out the window the other day, for example, and I saw the garbage being picked up, and I looked at the fact that there is a special truck to do this. There are special containers, and if I compare that today with how garbage was collected 30 years ago, you see an enormous improvement in productivity. Now, you talk about some of the issues that existed in the 50s, the post-World War II era, that allowed us to grow at those growth rates. There's one phenomenon right now which I believe is really unparalleled in all history, and that's the advent of the computer. And there have been comparisons with what is technology like a computer, how does that contribute to productivity growth versus, say, the advent of electricity. And here's my take on how I perceive the computer to be different. I perceive the computer not only to have direct effect on productivity of specific tasks, I perceive it also to be affecting how quickly other technology is developed, and that to me is what makes it unique. My background is in computers, and I have firsthand knowledge, anecdotal knowledge of benefits that come from computerization. Those are just beginning to show up in this economy, and they're going to affect virtually all aspects of it over the next couple of decades.
What seems to be happening with this new economy that we have is that the gap between the people who are doing well and the people who aren't is getting wider and wider. What, in your mind, could or should be done about that?
I have less concern with the division of wealth and the fact, if there were barriers to the creation of new wealth, I'd be very concerned about that. If there's something that prevents somebody from coming out of college and being able to generate a fortune, something that would prevent that from even being possible, and have real concerns. But the opposite is true. We're seeing a lot of wealth being created, a lot of people becoming wealthy, and a lot of it, it's very young people. It's real encouraging. I see nothing negative in that at all. It is important that we see increases in per capita income for everybody. And when I talk about the need for getting productivity growth in this country, I'm concerned You know, if we can get the 3% productivity growth, per capita, average per capita income in this country will grow, will double in approximately 23 years.
For everybody or just for the high-flying
Bill
Gates types?
Well, I'm assuming that society will work that out. It's a different discussion, but, you know, if you look at where most wealth is, it's not, the Bill Gates is the exception. Awful lot of wealth. There's an interesting book out recently, and I haven't quite finished it yet, but it talks about who is the average millionaire out there. And you realize that most millionaires are not the Bill Gates type. They're the small business person that's simply worked very hard and been frugal and doesn't spend a lot and lives in a very average neighborhood and has simply accumulated wealth.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, your question, please.
As a software developer, I'm happy to see a candidate who probably knows the port to which one telnets. For too long, U.S. policy regarding computers, which change yearly, have been drafted by people who haven't changed anything but their clothes since the 1970s. But my question is, what is your position regarding the export of strong cryptography by the software industry?
Haven't given it a lot of thought, Ryan.
First of all, a brief mention of what is strong cryptography?
Cryptography, we have national security concerns, so there's concern about exporting technology that would allow foreign countries to use it to their advantage militarily. The issue of cryptography, Craig, are you still on the line?
Let me see if I can get him back here. I think he's... Ryan, there you are.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Why don't you explain the cryptography, if you would?
Secure cryptography are codes that the U.S. government would take more than an hour to break.
So you're concerned, the concern has to do with foreign countries having this technology so they can relay messages without our ability to decrypt them, is that it?
No, it's the U.S. companies being able to export their products that they use and can sell freely in America that do use strong cryptography.
Okay.
No one overseas will buy a U.S. product that uses cryptography because they know it was intentionally weakened by the U.S. government. This policy assumes that no other country is intelligent enough to make secure cryptography when, of course, the best is coming from Norway and Australia right now.
Okay.
We're only crippling U.S. software industry.
Okay, I would say you've got a real good take on that, and that most efforts of that kind would be counterproductive to limit the exports.
In terms of national security, how about defense spending? Are we spending too much? Not enough? Are we spending it in the right way, wrong way? What's your thought?
Well, I think we probably are a little bit on the shy side of late, and I think we've begun to realize that, and changes have taken place. We're dealing in a different kind of world, and we need to assess that. The issue of fighting these smaller battles in different theaters and possibly multiple theaters at the same time is the issue. It's not whether we're going to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, but that's something I need to really assess.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you're next.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I don't have a question. I just have an observation, which is this. It's really refreshing to find, to hear someone, and maybe you're finding this too, Gary. It's really refreshing to hear someone who's not a professional politician, who's not, blow dry end of the spectrum, but at the let's find out how it works part of the spectrum. If the more of those people that we can get into Washington, I think the better off all of us will be, because instead of spending most of their time working on, how to outmaneuver or outspin their opponents, they might be actually spending their time on something useful, like finding out, how to do something about the budget or how to solve, some other problems that are, mm-hmm. they're real problems and they need real attention, not just, posturing.
I appreciate that, Tom. Gary asked me earlier in the show about career politicians. And one danger, I suppose, of being a career politician is that you're dependent on this industry, on the political industry, and I suppose you have a concern about maintaining your role in that. And the advantage of people coming in from the outside is they have a life, they have a career outside of that, and they're not dependent on winning, and They're more concerned with the principles they take to the office, accomplishing things when they get there. You know, it's not clear that I would get there and be concerned at all about being reelected. I might be happy, very, very happy just to serve a single term.
I was going to say, what about term limits? Do you think those are a good idea for the political world?
I don't have a solid opinion on that. I did comment yesterday, I think, to another person from NPR that I'm 46 years old, and three terms, 6 years apiece would be 18 years, I'd be eligible for Social Security, so I'd have no problem with a term limit of three.
Plus the congressional pension, I think, too.
Yeah, no, I don't have an opinion on it. I don't think it's a panacea, that's for sure.
Other side of that coin, though, Mr. Gibson, is if you went off to Washington, and presumably, of course, you know, during the course of campaign, the election isn't going to be for a year and a half yet, and you'll bone up on a lot of these issues. But wouldn't voters have the right to expect that the fellow they're sending to Washington really knows these issues and isn't going to spend a lot of time learning on the job?
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think anybody that goes to Washington is going to do a lot of learning there. There's just no way you're going to get to be an expert in all of these issues before you go, and even after you're there, you're not going to be an expert. You need to, my guess is each senator, each congressman tends to have some specialty, the kind of committee they get on. That's where they become the expert. Every day for me is a study day at this point. This is essentially a full-time occupation for me, boning up on the issues, and I do have a year and a half to do that, and I fully expect to be ready.
Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of time left, but let's get one more quick comment from a question from a listener. Go ahead, Dick.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Gibson. Good of you to be concerned and running. I have a short comment and a question. Most of us, it's on the Social Security issue, most of us have a continuing challenge trying to figure out how to allocate our investments, and even with study, what is your plan for those who make bad investment choices, albeit well-meaning, and don't have assets, or the cycle is down at the point of needing it? My question specifically is, what is the probable cost built into your plan for helping those who are on the downside of a cycle, or okay, who made choices, and who will make the decision? Will you add people to government as to who gets that bailout? I have a problem with the plan, obviously.
Okay. Not a lot of time here, Mr. Gibson, to answer, but
okay. A very good point, Dick, and I think it has to do with the kinds of investments we allow. You raised the issue of the downside of the cycle. There's a case to be made, and it's going to take some research. There's a case to be made when the conversion of the investment account to when that gets annuitized, that is there a way of phasing in the annuitization? That's something I want to look at.
Mm-hmm. Can we expect an aggressive James Gibson campaign for the Senate? Are we going to see a lot and hear a lot from you over the next while, or what's your approach going to be?
I think you will. My focus right now is on getting the issues down, building the website. So I hope you all take a look at the website, by the way. GibsonForSenator.org, if I can work that in. And I'm going to bone up on the issues. I'm going to try to get out and do as much public speaking as I can. If you get to the state fair, look for me there. I'll be at the Reform Party booth. And, yes, this will be an aggressive campaign.
Well, thanks for coming in today. Good luck to you.